This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Welcome to Critics at Large, a podcast from The New Yorker. I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
And I'm Vincent Cunningham. Each week on this show, we make sense of what's happening in the culture right now and how we got here. Now, if you're the kind of thrill seeker whose idea of a good time is to watch your own country torn to shreds by brutal war, boy, do we have a movie for you. It's called Civil War. You may have heard of it. It's the big, buzzy new movie from A24, and it is written and directed by Alex Garland.
Citizens of America,
people of the Florida Alliance,
you gotta move!
And the Western forces of Texas and California will be welcomed back to these United States as soon as their illegal secessionist government is deposed.
Garland's vibe, I think, if I had to describe it.
And you do.
And it is my job to do so.
Your duty, your job.
Is that he is an artist of the worst case scenario. What are some of his films that sort of fit this bill?
Well, I'm thinking of Ex Machina. That's a movie about AI and, you know, a beautiful woman who's actually an AI, mm-hmm. played by Alicia Vikander, is being held captive by, I think, Oscar Isaac.
By definitely Oscar
yes.
Isaac.
Yes. Yeah, he was
great in
that movie.
Is that the worst case scenario?
You are dead center of the greatest scientific event in the history of man.
Hello.
Hi. Do you have a name?
Ava.
Self-awareness, manipulation, sexuality.
Are you attracted to me?
Now, if that isn't true AI, what is?
Every time you see a movie that's either written or directed by him, you can almost imagine him like leafing through headlines and catastrophizing over each one and imagining the most spectacular ways in which they could go wrong. And this new movie, Civil War, kind of continues in that vein. It's about a civil war that has broken out on American soil. So, Civil War came out this weekend. It's a big box office hit,
It's the biggest movie in the country.
Yeah. And one of the things that struck me watching it was that I've seen trailers about this for a long time, and it was marketed as like a political thriller.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that at all. It's the farthest thing from that you could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
The politics of the warring factions, for instance, are pointed toward, but left fairly vague. We don't get to know any like soldiers or everyday citizens trying to survive or political leaders, good or bad, anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, the real action comes to us through the point of view of these journalists.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. Every instinct in me says this is death.
What?
Every time I survived a war zone, I thought I was sending a warning home. Don't do this. But here we are.
There's some kind of misunderstanding here.
What do you guys think about it?
So I have not had such a visceral response to a movie in a very long time.
Oh,
really?
Wow.
Yes.
Well.
And that caught me off guard, I will say. It has been a long time since it's not just adrenaline I'm talking about. Adrenaline was definitely going. But since I left the movie theater with a real feeling of like, oh, what just happened to me?
Yeah.
It really got me. And so in some ways, my mind, it's good that I'm saying, I saw it yesterday. So my brain is now in the process of catching up. But definitely the emotional reaction was very unexpectedly intense.
My feelings were mixed. I agree with Alex that I was definitely gripped by it. And I don't think it was a great movie, but in some ways, I think it succeeded in what it was trying to do. But it might have succeeded because it kind of like used some easy tricks, which weren't unenjoyable, but which I don't know if I totally respect, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And we can talk about this.
Yeah. So that's what I want us to talk about. we're delving into this terrifying hypothetical laid out by Alex Garland. Not talking just about war, but about how war is delivered to us in the press, through all kinds of images, and eventually, as in this case, in popular art. That's today on Critics at Large. Alex Garland, Civil War, and the Power of the Image. Okay, so as we mentioned, Civil War opened this past weekend. And specifically, it opened on April 12th, which is the anniversary to the day of when the actual American Civil War began in 1861. I guess you could make of that what you will.
I mean, I make of it a marketing gesture, no?
Yes. Yes, but then it also, I think, as a marketing gesture, occasions new readings of what we saw.
Okay. Right. Like, okay. What is it trying to tell us by enacting this
marketing?
Okay,
we're going to do some reading. I understand. I understand.
Yeah. So we already said a kind of synopsis, but who wants to further set the scene?
Okay. So basically, we are talking about the near future of America.
That's right. Right.
And there's a situation of a civil war. We don't totally know what's happening. Mm-hmm. We're sort of dropped into it in media stress. And also, we will never know what's happening. You know, like it doesn't, the political situation that occasioned this secession and what have you is never explained. We get these hints. We know that the president is on his third term. So, you know, we're sensing that.
He has disbanded the FBI.
We know that journalists have been shot on the White House lawn. You know, so as you said, Texas and California have seceded and are part of these Western forces. Florida potentially is also another.
The Florida Alliance,
The Florida Alliance. But it's all quite vague.
Yes.
Okay. So this is the situation we're dropped into. And it gets focalized by these four journalists, right? So we have Kristen Dunst, who is Lee, a decorated war photographer. We have Joel, who's a reporter, played by Wagner Moura. And both he and Lee work for Reuters. It emerges over the course of the movie. We have this young, aspiring war photographer, Jesse, played by Kaylee Spaney, who is joining these two more kind of seasoned journalists. And then we have Sammy, who's an older, you know, on the verge of retirement, New York Times reporter played by Stephen McKinley Henderson. And all of these four characters decide to go from one war scene in New York and travel to D.C. to try to get an interview with the president. So it's kind of like the movie is kind of a road movie in a way, in that way, right?
Lee, I'm sorry for jamming my way into your ride, okay? I know you're really angry about it, and I know you think I don't know shit, but
I'm not angry about that, Jesse. I don't care what you do or don't know.
Okay, but you are angry with me.
There is no version of this that isn't a mistake. I know, because I'm it. Joe and Sammy are it.
It's my choice.
Right. And I'll remember that when you lose your shit or you get blown up or shot.
And what happens to these journalists on this journey is the core of this movie more than any kind of like ideological takeaway, I would say.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Right. We don't understand one thing about this war.
Yeah.
It is nothing about this war is clear. Why have Texas and California seceded? Why have they formed an alliance? Who is fighting on behalf of the United States of America? Where is the, you know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This is a government that is very capable of crushing a lot of people. So where is the crushing?
There's no crushing.
There's no crushing. It's like a guerrilla conflict, which is also an interesting choice.
Yeah.
But politically, absolutely void. Like, you know, had heard a bit about this movie in advance, and people were making a lot of references to January 6th. This is like this idea of what if January 6th had succeeded. Sort of, I guess, in that, like, you know, we see the halls of power overrun by a bunch of, you know, hoodlums and fatigues kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But definitely not at all, because we have no idea what they stand for. We have no idea who their leader is.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we don't even know anything about this president who's sort of called a fascist and compared to, like, Ceausescu and Mussolini, but we don't know why. We only know that he's had a third term.
So can I ask you why the visceral reaction that you mentioned earlier? What was the part of it that made you have that sort of full body reaction once you left the theater?
Yeah, so there are a few things I'm thinking about. One thing that Civil War does is that it renders very familiar places and scenes as, you know, the sites of brutal and hideous carnage.
Yeah.
And that's very effective. Whether it is a scene in Brooklyn where you're watching a sort of riot go down, only from reading reviews, by the way, did I gather that this had to do with water rationing. It was not...
No, not clear at all.
Yeah, not clear. And that's okay. Like, expositionally, the movie is not that interested in details like that. That's not where its focus is.
Right.
But, you know, the journalists all to make this trip that Nomi described to D.C., they're driving down a highway and they pull up to a gas station. They're somewhere in Pennsylvania. The gas station is being manned by some dudes with guns. Mm-hmm. There is a negotiation over whether they can buy gas and at what price.
Got a little fuel permit?
No, we're actually just passing through.
Can't help, sir.
Sir, if we pay.
I was never going to give it free.
Over the odds.
What's over the odds?
300. For half a tank and two cans?
300 buys you a sandwich. We got ham or cheese?
300 Canadian.
Okay.
Quite clearly, we're meant to understand not only is all not well, nothing is well. Things have totally devolved. We're in a real the road situation. My thought about that was, okay, I see what Alex Garland is trying to do. He is basically giving us very viscerally and directly the experience of, to me, first and foremost, at this moment in time, maybe people in Ukraine. Gaza is also something on my mind, but it's slightly different.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is in this society, there are still pieces of the American society that are functioning normally where you can pretend that stuff is okay and all right. You know, Kaylee Spaney's character, Jesse, her dad is still on the farm in Missouri pretending nothing has ever happened. So that reminded me, you know, of like how we've seen stories recently of like coffeehouse culture still trying to persist and thrive in Kyiv because some kind of normalcy is important, even as other parts of society and a country that looked totally normal, you know, 2 years ago has been completely ravaged.
That's right.
In front of your eyes. So that was much more devastating to me than, you know, the attack on the White House, which was for me much more of a part of an American tradition of let's imagine disaster at the highest levels, you know.
That's right.
So those things were very effective. And then there was something else that I hope you guys can help me put a finger on, because this is what I'm trying to articulate to myself. And it was the way that violence was portrayed. There is a lot of violence in this movie.
Yeah, it's a very violent movie.
It's a super violent movie. And you see executions. You see point-blank killings. You see explosions. You see, you know, comrades trying to save the life of a man as he flounders around on the ground with blood pouring out of him. Now, we are pretty used to violence in the American cultural sphere. But something about this kind of violence was pretty horrifying and gross. And I think and like I say that as a positive for the movie.
Yeah.
And I think maybe it had to do with this weird – like maybe the – what did it have to do with? I'm trying to answer for myself.
Nomi, like does this connect, by the way, to your thing about – cheap tricks, like
a little
the violence,
yes,
and the sort of shock and awe. Is that all sort of encompassed in what you were talking about?
Yeah, and I'm struggling with myself because there's something that's very attractive to me about these tactics, and I think it has to do to. I feel like I'm probably around Alex Garland's age. I'm not sure, like he's, but he. I feel like much like myself. he grew up in the 90s. That was a feeling I had when I was watching this movie, thinking about like a certain attitude towards violence. You know, when I was watching it, I was like, oh, this is kind of like he's taking a page from like Oliver Stone's like Natural Born Killers or like Gregor Aki's like Doom Generation or something, or even like Tarantino, although the tone is very tonally, it's very different from Tarantino. But the idea of kind of like violence as spectacle and a kind of like amorality about it, of kind of like, okay, we're just going to sort of capture this. And it's even going to have some humor to it sometimes, you know, and there's something about the point of view of the journalists who are kind of hardened. And of course, there is Jesse, the younger aspiring photojournalist, who's kind of like, you know, but the whole journey of her over the course of the movie is, I'm going to become hardened to this, you know, and it ends. And I don't know if I should do this a spoiler, but it ends in a very kind of like LOL Abu Ghraib kind of vibe of like a shot of a triumphant shot of violence and dominance, you know, and so that's kind of so I'm on the one hand, this kind of attitude feels familiar to me. Mm-hmm. And kind of like exciting and attractive, just because that's it kind of like rubs against something in me that enjoys it. And I think many people probably do mm-hmm. enjoys while also being horrified and kind of, you know, that sort of valence. But on the other hand, I'm like, okay, but this is also kind of cheap. Like I'm in my 40s. Like I was a teenager when I was like, oh my God, like look at that blood
gush.
But
I actually read it totally differently than you, which is interesting that you're saying
this. Interesting.
Because
okay.
I thought it was sort of the opposite in a lot of ways. I thought one thing that Garland was trying to do was to point out that we've been trained to see violence in exactly the way you described, Naomi, but that the movie acts as a kind of indictment of that way of seeing violence. Yes, there are moments. There's particularly one very notable moment where the photojournalists, they're kind of embedded momentarily with a group of, we're not totally sure who. It does seem like they're from the Western forces, but like a little unit, a little secessionist unit that is attacking a bigger armed unit. And the scene is shot in a real war scene kind of way. Screams, cries, bleeding out, very intense, adrenaline-inducing, very scary, horrible. And then they kill one guy. They take out a bunch of other guys with bags over their heads. And then the mood shifts completely. There's a De La Soul song playing. Mm-hmm. It's exactly what you described. It's kind of like the journalists are now chilling. They get their break. They're off duty as all these prisoners are taken out and executed by a grinning maniac. There's a slow motion kind of watching the bullet casing, the mm-hmm. shell casings mm-hmm. like come off his machine gun. But the movie plays with that kind of thing a lot, but I don't think it's like a Tarantino-esque way of saying, look how bad I am. I'm going there. You can't believe what I'm doing. I think the point is, and what it also asks through the framing of the journalists is, what happens when we look at all this violence? What is the point of looking at so much violence?
In a minute, from Civil War to Susan Sontag, Joan Didion, and more. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast. On the podcast, I ask a great contemporary writer to select a favorite story from the magazine's almost 100-year archive to read and discuss. Together, we delve into the story, exploring its themes, its style, and what makes fiction work. You can listen to authors like Otessa Moshfegh talk about why we write.
Story, or attaching a story or creating a story, is this inclination that we all have to stop spinning.
And you can hear writers like George Saunders discuss the nature of storytelling.
On the first read, you accept these things as descriptions, and they make you see the scene. But every line is a chance to inflect the reader's mind.
you'll discover new favorite authors and read old favorites in new ways. Episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast are released on the first of every month. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
I think that this movie, at its best, is about photography. I guess I should say that.
Yes.
The Lee character, Kirsten Dunst, she's the sort of, like, at one point, Jesse, the younger one, calls her, like, war-torn. Like, you know, she's the grizzled veteran who has found a way to compartmentalize the images that she sees. She says, weird, you know, at a moment where she sees these two men that are, like, off to the side of a gas station. They've been, like, trussed up, and they're being tortured over many days, it sounds like, bleeding. Kirsten Dunst immediately just, like, gets the picture, right?
I didn't take a single photo. I didn't even remember I had cameras on me. Like, oh, my God. Like, why didn't I just tell him not to shoot them?
They're probably going to kill them anyway.
How do you know?
He doesn't know, but that's besides the point. Once you start asking yourself those questions, you can't stop. So we don't ask. We record so other people ask. Want to be a journalist? That's the job.
Hey, Lee.
What?
Back off.
What am I saying that's wrong?
I'm not saying it's wrong. She's just shook up.
Lee doesn't understand shook up.
Whoa. I'm not being protected.
And after that, she says, we're not there to ask questions. We're there to get images so that others can ask questions. Sometimes we see, like, the snapshots frozen on the screen. She shoots digital and in color.
Mm.
Color, kinetic, every part of the frame is some sort of information.
Mm.
On the other hand, and sort of paradoxically, the younger character, Jesse, Kaylee Spaney, shoots on film.
Mm.
She's like an old school
right.
purist. And she, like, we see her, like, developing her film on the go and all these things. And there's a moment in another one of these, like, battle scenes, battle skirmishes, this one guy is, like, trying to move from, you know, behind a post, and he is shot down. And one of his compatriots, like, goes over him to try to, like, you know, take care of him to stanch the wound. And there's a moment where both of their arms go out at the same time, like, almost like as if mimicking one another.
Mm-hmm.
And we see, again, a snapshot in black and white
mm-hmm.
of that, you mm-hmm. know, a kind of more aestheticized form of violence. I was thinking about a recent book. I don't know if you guys saw it. It's called War is Beautiful by the writer David Shields.
No.
And it is a compendium of images, war images from the New York Times.
Mm.
The point being that, you know, one of the faults of war photography is that it has tended to aestheticize and therefore, like, glorify and heroize soldiers and war. So the movies that you're talking about, Nomi, like, they are, like, maybe examples of a former attitude toward, like, that we can be objective about violence.
Yeah.
And this movie maybe says it's impossible to do so.
Right.
You know, that depiction is always a form of interpretation, even
yeah.
though Lee does not think so. We were just, you know, we're just handing off the image, whatever.
And, yeah.
And the people will decide. Like, it's like, no, the image itself is not just information. It is already analysis.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's one huge question in this movie that you make me think of, Vincent,
mm-hmm.
which is, who is seeing the photographs?
That's exactly
who is seeing the works?
We never see them send them out.
Well, that's
because
the thing.
It's
honestly ridiculous. Okay, yeah, sorry. Go ahead and
mean, it's a major question because the society is completely devolved. You know, basically no one can use their smartphones anymore. The press, it's clear that these institutions are a shambles of what they once were. Like, it's almost funny at a certain moment that they say that they're from Reuters because who's watching them?
Yeah.
It's the equivalent of if a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it. For whom
yeah.
are they making the images? And it has to do also with how we see these
yeah.
things. You know, of course, we can hearken back to the stone cold classic on the genre, Susan Sontag's On Photography.
Yep.
Yes.
You know, her point,
mm-hmm.
if I can summarize the entirety of that book super quickly, and oh my God, that's, you know, nerve-wracking
to do. If anybody can do it, you can do
it. It's very nerve-wracking to do, but one of the points in that work is that the sheer proliferation of images renders them all equal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the more used to aestheticized horror you get, the less of an effect it has.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So are we to take from that, you know, these images are going out into a public who just sort of is scanning over them on their farms in Missouri or whatever and moving on with their days, perhaps.
Right. But it's, I think it is kind of key that we don't – at the very beginning of the movie, we see Kirsten Dunst's character, Lee, at the hotel lobby, you know, in New York where – all of these journalists congregate and
getting drunk, commiserating,
yeah,
talking
classic
shit.
Sort of like war, you know, war reporter
I was
stuff.
Into that scene.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah,
like that scene.
Yeah, no, it's so. And she's trying to upload images. So she's like, oh, it's not. I can't finish this upload, you know, because the internet keeps the lights go off. The you know the internet keeps going in and out. But that's the one time that we do see these images kind of going anywhere. I mean, it kind of bugged me because we're writers, maybe. Mm-hmm. I was like, these people, like, are they filing anything? Like, what's, I mean, not that I need to see every second the nitty gritty of like, of like the work, but if you're doing a, like a movie about journalists, I think it is kind of significant that we see it going nowhere. And I think it – bear with me because I think this has kind of like slightly broader meaning for the movie. Mm-hmm. It reminds me when I was like in eighth grade and I had this like boyfriend.
Please go on.
And he was like – this was a very brief – I don't think he thought he was my boyfriend. But this was like – anyway, he would walk around with a camera – because he was artsy, right? And so he would try to sort of like, you know, lock in like, you know, aspiring artsy girls. And I later on, somebody said to me, you know, I heard that he never even had film in his camera. So this notion of kind of like
photography as opposed
photography on empty.
Uh-huh.
That really kind of like when I was watching the movie, I was like, okay, we're seeing these pictures on screen with like no kind of like deeper meaning. And just to make clear, I enjoy it. You know what I mean? That's what I'm kind of was talking about with like the tricks of like.
I understand, yeah.
And it's effective, you know? It's enjoyable and effective. But what is it? What really are we getting? I'm not against it, but I'm questioning it.
Now I kind of want to just bring into the frame. And of course, this is very fresh. It just came out. But there has been a lot of reception to this film, specifically around these questions of journalism and the sort of apolitical approach to journalism that Alex Garland has. He has said in several interviews that, you know, on some level, he admires or admired a previous form of journalism that was all about the facts, was all about sort of objectivity. And therefore, the relative apolitical texture, the objective, I guess, in quotations, texture of this movie is a response to the point of view of that kind of journalist. I wonder if that, like, this issue of, on the one hand, objectivity, on the other hand, journalism, had anything to do with your reaction, Alex.
Okay, well, this objectivity question is very interesting precisely because of what I was mentioning before, which is we don't know who they're really making work for, like who is reading the Reuters, et cetera, what's going on there. Because without an audience that you're addressing, objectivity, it's not the same question. There are two sides to that coin.
Mm-hmm.
I will say one thing about the depiction of these journalists, which maybe relates to this. It's a little bit different. But one thing that journalism is a job and an activity. And by that I mean that of course you want the best shot and of course you want the most intense moment to capture it. And yes, adrenaline can drive you. All these things are true. And I thought that the movie in some cases went too far with that, especially with the character of Joel who, you know, is seen like whooping his head off after some scenes of violent slaughter because it's implied.
What a rush.
Yeah, he's becoming, he screams what a rush, right? He's become an adrenaline junkie and kind of lives for this thing. But you know what it made me think of was Joan Didion, who in the documentary that her nephew Griffin Dunn made about her a few years ago was asked about writing her very famous essay from the late 60s, Slouching Towards Bethlehem, in which embedded in the Haight-Ashbury scene and the kind of hippie burnout scene, the essay ends unforgettably with a 5-year-old who's on acid.
Yeah.
And she's asked, well, what did you feel in that moment?
What was it like to be a journalist in the room when you saw the little kid on acid?
Well, it was... Let me tell you, it was gold. I mean, that's the long and the short of it is you live for the for moments like that if you're doing a piece, good or bad.
That was an interesting flashpoint because people who saw that movie, I think some were horrified and some immediately got it. Mm-hmm. I immediately got it. Of course, you know what she means.
Yeah.
Now, does that lead to a clean moral conscience at the end of the day where you go to sleep and sleep well? I don't think it really does very often.
No.
You know, I have a slightly different interpretation of the Kirsten Dunst scene where she encounters this trussed up, you know, I think they were trying
bleeding.
To, they were kind of looters trying
That's
to loot
right.
this gas station. And she takes a picture. Well, she sort of does it, I think, to protect the younger journalist who is in a bit of a iffy
Shot
position.
Moment.
Yeah, and also with this creepy guy who has, let's not forget, an enormous automatic weapon on him.
Mm-hmm.
She almost uses photography in that moment as a way to disarm,
mm-hmm.
as a way to say, yeah, do you want a claim? Do you want status? Sure. Let me go back to our traditional way of giving you that. Let me snap
Portrait,
a picture.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is something like the
sure.
power of the camera does – there is a disarming power,
mm-hmm.
Especially, you know, historically it's been used with people doing egregious things, but wanting to show them off and demonstrate them. I mean, Nomi, you mentioned Abu Ghraib, one
mm-hmm.
of the absolute most indelible images
mm-hmm.
of the last, forget the century, the last 100 years, soldiers posing with a torture victim
yeah.
with thumbs up. You know, could never get that image out of my mind if I tried. Well, why do people pose for the camera at moments like this? Because they're proud of their actions and they want them recorded. I feel like that power of the camera and how it's used by the subject of the photo, we get glimpses of it, you know, in self-heroizing subjects here, but we don't get a full view.
In a minute, what is the power of an image in politics today? Stick around.
Who are the risk takers that help reinvent and reimagine the kinds of stories we see on TV? We Disrupt This Broadcast, a brand new podcast from the Peabody Awards and the Center for Media and Social Impact, talks to creators of TV shows like Abbott Elementary, Watchmen, Black Mirror, and Better Things to explore how the most compelling shows and the creative powers behind them are upending the status quo. Listen to We Disrupt This Broadcast now, available where you get your podcasts.
I kind of want to return to what we talked about, this whole thing of the Wi-Fi is bad, and therefore
we can't send anything anywhere.
Yeah. I think for me that was – and I feel very mixed about this movie too. Like I kind of am still thinking about it. And but I did think that that was a cop-out and a missed opportunity because there is not a single smartphone image in this movie or anything that would – seem to be a new technology. Like, you know, the actual Civil War that we did have was a moment like it occasioned new technologies. Like there were, first of all, there were battleground sketch artists, and then they would send their sketch to the newspaper and then they'd make a woodcut of that and that's how it would be proliferated. And then like lithography and photography came, you know, during the war to be adjunct to the practice of photography and also adjunct to the practice of changing the minds of people.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, the portrayals of black people,
mm-hmm.
All of these things came into fruition and changed during the Civil War,
mm-hmm.
right? And so today I'm thinking about specifically, Alex, you mentioned Gaza before,
mm-hmm.
the horrible imagery that we have seen,
yeah.
dead children, missing limbs, all this horrible stuff
yeah.
has come to us not as often from the news media, but through people's phones.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've seen a lot of images that are like specifically fitted for our phone screens, and they have in fact affected the politics of that war. So like I'm wondering, first of all, maybe we could just talk more about this issue of what
the technology
first of all,
and image.
Why no cell phones? And second of all, what we expect an image to do in politics today.
Well, I think this question of the cell phone image versus the professional image is really interesting. We are at a point, as you say, Vincent, right now, where the cell phone image is absolutely essential, but it hasn't totally overtaken the official photojournalist image. I mean, just talking about the war in Gaza, we see both. And I think both are very important. And of course, as we all know, and as bears repeating infinite times, journalists have been an enormous casualty in Gaza, which is like the most dangerous place for journalists on the planet. And that's a grave understatement. But I'm thinking of two galvanizing images right now from the recent past. One is the George Floyd video, which, yes, is a video, not a single still image, but was distributed, was taken on a cell phone by a passerby, you know, just a bystander, an onlooker, and went around the country and the globe immediately. And a lot of the visceral power of that is knowing that precisely it was an ordinary moment in an ordinary day. Why would a photojournalist be there? Of course a photojournalist wouldn't be there.
Right.
It's like a normal afternoon and someone standing there whips out their phone and takes a video. The second image I'm thinking of is the image of the Syrian boy, Alan Kurdi, dead on a Turkish beach. That image was taken by a photojournalist.
Absolutely,
it was taken by a Turkish photojournalist. And it traveled also around the world. And, you know, this came after years of children dying trying to leave Syria. I still have trouble thinking and articulating about why that one image of this tiny body got through in this way that other images didn't. But all I can say is that that journalist knew that there was power there, clearly. You know, I'd been reading something about this where, you know, often people like – it may be understood or accepted that people don't want to see violence all the time, you know, contrary to like us going to all these violent movies and all these things. You know, I'm even thinking of like, and I know I'm getting a little wide ranging here, but how during the war in Iraq, you were not allowed, news media was not allowed to show coffins coming off the planes.
And I think too, that has a lot to do with, I mean, I'm thinking about Gaza and I think about how the idea that kind of like ideology overrides the imagery, right? So I'm thinking about how in Israel, Israelis don't see on the news what's going on in Gaza. They don't. So it's different for me. You know, I have family in Israel, and my family specifically happen to be aware. Some people happen to be aware, but a lot of people aren't. They don't want to be aware. And they're not allowed to be aware in a certain – they would have to seek it out really actively to know what is going on. And most people don't want to do that. That's just the way things are with humans, right? And so there is a kind of like the readiness, the ability to see these images, which are very important to see, to understand what is happening, is – often overridden by ideology, like what you said about not showing coffins coming off a plane, you know, from the war in Iraq. The strength of images could be, you know, could be there, but some images, people either don't want to see them or aren't able to see them.
The way you said that, Naomi, like the sort of ideology preceding the image is so interesting because the presumed neutrality of the news image can be a way, it can be a sort of vaccine against the information of the citizen image. You know, sometimes when you listen to like news figures in Israel, they're saying, you know, unfortunately, the Palestinians are winning the propaganda war.
Sure.
These other images are flooding in and that's what's coming in with a slant. The immediacy and the sort of amateur nature of their capture is precisely the argument against them, whereas someone else would say that is the evidence of its like actual like relationship to truth. I had one thing that I still don't know whether I liked or did not like about this movie, which is the recurrence of the imagery of lynching. So we've talked about these guys that are trussed up but barely alive, but they're hanging by ropes.
Yeah.
And there's another moment that is totally wordless where they're driving down like a highway and you can see the interstate, like, you know, the lanes above them. And then in the distance, you can see that there are people hanging from the highway.
Right. And in the foreground, they're by Pittsburgh. In the foreground on the overpass is written Ghost Dealers. And then That's your right. eye focuses on that and you go, ha ha. And then you look behind it and see the bodies.
Yeah. That's right. And it reminded me, again, of a moment where, you know, the power of images. There used to be, you know, famously postcards from a lynching.
Yeah.
And the images are, you know, black, often men hanging from trees. And people like... in like a picnic atmosphere otherwise. People like these hauntingly
white people smiling. Yeah.
White people smiling yeah. and like it's like they were – it's like at the most fun barbecue you could ever imagine. And of course the valence of those images changes. You know, they were meant as celebratory images and today they are haunting reminders of a not-so-distant past. But it made me wonder too whether we think – whether you guys think that images have that kind of power today. Like because – we are sort of, you know, on some level victims of image fatigue, as you know, we've all kind of pointed toward. Do we think that there is that opportunity today, for good or ill, for an image to, not to put too fine a point on it, but like change the world?
I think probably not. I don't think it's impossible. And, you know, there are various examples of images that have brought on political change. But I do think that the glut of imagery is a real thing, you know, is a real thing. And I think there has been a kind of reduction in the significance and the import and the effect of images because of how much we're exposed to. And I think the refusal to include that type of images in the movie is kind of in order to heighten the status of the image, the images that are being taken by these protagonists. So the world of the movie is not the world we live in terms of like...
That's right.
Regardless of whether the images that are being taken in the movie, the photographs are going anywhere or not, the fact that we see them on the screen... And the fact that, you know, we kind of like feel their effect to kind of the exclusion of all other types of images is different from the way we treat images right now in our everyday lives. Like we must scroll through thousands and thousands of images every day on our like little personal device.
And today many of them feature dead bodies. Like today... saw many dead bodies this morning.
Yeah. So it's like dead body next to like an ad for like a certain type of sweater, you know, and like a fast mimicking like diet plan and a, you know, and your friend's kids and your, you know, yeah. And like a thirst trap, you know, it's like, it's a glut. It's a glut.
I think the reality is really paradoxical. These things are all totally true that you say. And the way that we consume images is madness incarnate.
Yeah. It's crazy.
What you're describing is madness. And it's without precedent and will come to seem quaint, I think we can safely say, especially as we enter into the age of increasingly altered images. Like, you know, we discussed the photograph of Princess Kate recently, the doctored photograph. It's touching to me. And I think I said this then, that it was as obviously doctored as it was, because soon that will not be the case. But we cannot count the image out. We just can't. The reason why there are so many of them is because they have an enormous power over us.
You're right.
And the kind of alchemical thing that happens with a certain image where it just grabs a bunch of people at the same time, it's very hard to predict, in fact, impossible to predict what that particular image will be. But they come around. They come around regularly. I know, you know, as surely as I know the sun will rise tomorrow, that there will be another one. I know it. Absolutely there will. You know, I think all of us are struggling with what to make of this complete overabundance. You know, I go back again to Sontag's very reasonable idea that we're becoming inured to visions of horror simply by overexposure. Yeah, totally true. But on the other hand, we are certainly aware of horror. We're very aware of it. Mm-hmm. We're not forgetting about it. It is right there. We know it. We see it. It's impossible to ignore. Maybe say, no, we're ignoring it just because we scroll through and go on to the next thing. But it's been seen. It's been noted. I don't even mean to say this is a kind of like optimistic rallying cry for, you know.
It doesn't sound like it. Yeah.
No, I don't feel that good. I don't feel that good.
Yay!
Yeah, it's so interesting, you know, as we mentioned, Garland has made much of like, you know, not wanting to spoon feed an interpretation to the audience. But I do think that this has to do with the reception of the film. Lots of people's response has been, you know, there's not a point or it's like sort of offensively apolitical. But what I think they actually mean is, yes, I see these images. But image making, especially photography, is a form of communication. You know, that like it's not finished until the image has been like recruited into one meaning or another. Like we receive them and then we coax them into a certain like, you know, camp or sort of field of meaning. And this is the thing about like, where are they sending these fucking pictures? That's the frustration, which is like, we don't want to see the image by itself. We need to understand the reception of the image. So it's almost like the audience crying out for a proxy for themselves, someone who receives and then therefore can like analyze that. Like, no, the threat of too many images is that they will like sort of override our capacity to analyze. This is why, you know, this is why the attention economy is dangerous, that we won't be able to pay good enough attention to the one thing. So maybe the sort of thin hope that you describe, Alex, is like, that we still retain some of our ability to attend to something.
Yeah.
And to like imbue it with meaning.
Totally.
Here's to meaning.
Here's to meaning. This isn't a cheerful movie about a cheerful time.
It
okay?
isn't.
We're not living in the best of times here.
That's right. That's right. We're not called optimists at large, people.
We are not.
We do want to let you know that we are off next week, but we hope that you guys get up to something fun. I mean, there has been an eclipse. We in New York had an earthquake. You might have heard about it. We're hoping that some beautiful...
What comes next?
Awe-inspiring natural phenomena happens to you. Who knows what comes next?
Who knows?
Awe-inspiring, but mostly safe.
Yeah, safe, exactly.
Yes.
Don't start a civil
Western
war out
hemisphere.
There.
Western hemisphere. Yeah. Please don't.
How did this go to an even darker place?
You guys have a great time, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
That just went so south.
This has been Critics at Large. Our senior producer is Rhiannon Corby, and Alex Barish is our consulting editor. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Condé Nast's head of global audio is Chris Bannon. Alexis Quadrado composed our theme music, and we had engineering help today from Jake Loomis, with mixing by Mike Kutchman. You can find every episode of Critics at Large at newyorker.com/critics, and as always, you can email us at themail@newyorker.com with the subject line Critics. See you soon!
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks.